If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret. Searching for the sound. This is The Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
So you long for the quiet, but the sounds keep coming, and you sit way back, and accept you got nothing, and now you throw your hands up, and let it all rain down, and now you sift through the rubble. Because it's there that you found. There's a light in the dark, and it's all for you. And now the sounds grow loud, and it was just what you needed. And so you stand up. Because the quiet has receded, and now you throw your hands up, and let it all rain down, and you can fill your cup up, because it's clear that you found, there's a light in the dark, and it's all for you.
Listening to Quiet from Adam Weinberg's forthcoming record, Laugh, Cry, Grief, Hope, due out May 13th, wherever you get music. The pandemic was no doubt a tough time for everyone, being huddled in your home, away from socializing, going out with friends, or even attending shows. A glimmer of hope, though, for many was the absolutely awesome Phish covers fingerstyle guitarist Adam Weinberg and his daughter performed for us on social media. That's where I first came across Adam, and indeed learned that he was a talented musician in his own right, having put out solo instrumental records and touring as Matisse Yahoo's accompaniment for many acoustic shows. I reached out to Adam to thank him for his absolutely wonderful Phish covers, and he immediately let me know that he was working on a solo record, and wondered if I would be interested in talking to him about the project closer to release. Well, some months later, and a few weeks before the release of Laugh, Cry, Grief, Hope, I did indeed catch up with Adam Weinberg, and we talked about his album, his struggles with mental illness, and our mutual love of Phish. This is a very personal record in many ways, and it's probably easier if you talk about how this album came about and what inspired you to create it.
Sure. I'll try to do the short version, but first, thanks for having me and all that. I feel very humbled and grateful. I keep joking with my wife, I'm the least known person to ever be on your podcast. So I appreciate it. So in about 2.5 years ago, I mean, I'd always been playing, you know, music either full-time or part-time for other people and writing a lot of instrumental music most of my, you know, music career, actually almost all instrumental music. And then our family kind of went through like a rough, what I call the 5-week hellish period, summer of 2019 into a little bit of 2021. It kind of extended into that. But basically our youngest son, who thank God now is fine, had a seizure disorder. And then my mom was, and then a few weeks later, my mom was rushed to the ICU like 3 times over the course of a month for an issue that she ended up having emergency surgery for. And it put her out for a while, and that kind of freaked everyone out. And then a few weeks after that, my brother-in-law, who I was very close with, passed away of a drug overdose. And my wife and I have known each other since we were 16. We're 42 now. So we met in Vermont chasing fish when we were both 16 years old. And I knew her brother for a long time. And, you know, like a lot of people with addiction, he had good years and bad years and good months and more challenging months. We were really intimately involved with his sort of recovery efforts for a long time. And so I personally had a very hard time sort of reconciling our efforts, you know, sort of in hindsight, it's a very egotistical way to look at things, but it's how I was looking at it, you know, like if we're helping, you know, why can't he get better, and not really understanding, you know, just being a bit ignorant about it, you know, not having those struggles myself. So I kind of lost my mind after those 5 weeks. You know, I always battled a little bit of anxiety here and there, but I just, from lack of sleep and sort of the medical necessities of those 5 weeks with my son and then my mom and then dealing with my brother-in-law's passing, I just lost it. There's no other way to say it. Like the wheels stopped running correctly. The gears weren't connecting in my head anymore. And nothing was making any sense. So I needed to get help. So I got help. And at some therapy session, my therapist said, you know, I knew her. I mean, she is in the scene, so to speak. Her husband and I, you know, go to a lot of shows, been a lot of shows together. And so I knew her. And she said, you know, what's it like playing guitar during this difficult period when you're battling anxiety and guilt and depression and all this? And I just said, you know, I haven't been playing, you know, I hadn't played in months. And she said, well, you know, that's a mistake. And, you know, you should play and you should have creative outlets. And she basically said, you know, she's a CBT therapist, cognitive behavioral therapy. So it was a lot of homework. And her homework was, you're going to play every night for at least, you know, 5 minutes, and you're going to record yourself playing. I don't care if you're covering a song, if you're writing a song, if you're improvising, but you're going to play for, you know, 3 to 5 minutes minimum. And you're going to record it in your voice memos, and you're going to send it to me every night as proof that you're doing this. So I did. And I started playing, you know, at least 5 to 6 nights a week at her instruction. You know, some people take pills. This is what I was doing. Took medication also, but started doing this. And before I knew it, I, you know, instead of it just being, it started as like noodling around and just some improvisation. And then within a few months of it, every night I was sitting down and writing songs. And by the end of, you know, 4 or 5 months, and the toughest mental period I went through lasted about 6 months. So at the end of 6 months, I probably have 30 songs, you know, at least 30 sketches of songs. And what was more, you know, meaningful to me was that I was writing lyrics for the first time ever, because that was just kind of the stuff that I was thinking about. And a lot of it was thinking about the other cognitive behavioral exercises she was giving me. So if it was like a exposure therapy or whatever it was that she wanted me working on, you know, I would kind of combine that with the guitar playing. You know, there was one, now I can laugh about it, some funny exercise where she actually had me record my own voice talking about my own fears and then playing that back on repeat all day long. It's a form of exposure therapy, which was completely insane. If you're like, you know, it sounds nuts. If you're super anxious about, you know, I don't know, dying of cancer, and then you record yourself talking about dying of cancer and you listen to yourself saying it. So I had to, even to do this exercise, I had to like sort of, I went to the, you know, I put the audio of my voice on top of some music, so it'd be at least somewhat listenable. So I was kind of playing with these ideas anyways. And I had these songs and I said, wow, you know, some of these are okay. And then I started kind of making demos. And then I have a friend of mine who's a drummer and a composer here in Miami, who's just an incredible musician, Arturo Garcia. And, you know, he can write for any instrument, and he's primarily a drummer though. And then we met and we said, you know, hey, what if we kind of like flush these out, and like maybe this song would be cool with strings or this song with horns. And we started working on it, and the pandemic hit and, you know, kind of paused. I played a tour, a short 6-run tour right before the pandemic at the end of January of 2020, opening up for Matsus Yahu. And I got to play some of those songs then, but they're, you know, pretty raw at that point. And so then I spent really the pandemic developing the songs, you know, with Arturo and other players here in Miami who are willing to put a mask on and come to my garage and screw around with them. And that's how the album came about.
I think it's interesting that you talk about the pandemic, because that's how I started to know about you, by seeing some of the work that you were, some of the covers that you were playing with your daughter, the Fish covers.
Yeah.
And I think that's how a lot of people got to know you.
Correct.
Was that part of the therapy, performing some of these songs? Was it, you know, father-daughter time because you were stuck at home? What was the impetus? And we'll get back to the record in a second, but
yeah, sure, of course.
It's a good way of introducing people to how I know you, at least.
Sure.
What was the impetus of those sessions, quote unquote, and how beautiful was it that you could get your daughter involved?
Well, it was amazing. And I now she's very busy again with being a 13-year-old, and I love her to death. And she takes voice lessons and piano lessons and is on the basketball team. So it's hard to get her anymore, but the pandemic was great for, you know, father-daughter time for sure. That started because, you know, my otherwise, you know, Parnassa earnings in life are concert production, and there were no concerts. Right. So my wife works in a hospital. So she was working a million hours a week due to COVID, and I was homeschooling the kids. So I had all the time in the world. There was no work, and everyone was in the house with me. So I just had to entertain myself. So the first part of the question was a part of the therapy. Yes, I can say with confidence that the last real anxiety attack I had was actually getting onto the bus in Mexico, going to Fish in Mexico in February of 2020, right before the pandemic. I remember getting on the bus being like, what the hell am I doing here with all these crazy people that I love? But it just felt overwhelming to me. And then, you know, 6 hours later, I was having the greatest time of my life. But I think I was over sort of the anxiety period in my life by the time the pandemic hit, or I'd just kind of gotten really out of the deepest part of it. But it certainly was really meaningful to do that with my daughter. And she, you know, is playing her music that at the time an 11 or 12 year old girl would play in the house, which is fine. And there's value in all of it. But I would say, you know, no problem, but how about this song? Why don't we learn this song? And then, you know, I bought a green screen and we were making these goofy videos and I was trying to get the family involved. And then Simone and I, my daughter, we wanted to really, you know, we just kind of made it a mission. Like every day when you're done with Zoom school, let's do something creative and we'll learn a song. And it started with songs that I knew, but maybe I didn't know how to play yet, because I wanted to challenge myself as well. And that's how it started. And yeah, people were really responsive to it, which was really great. And I was just experimenting with, you know, challenging myself in different ways to just spend time with the kids during the pandemic. But we covered a lot of tunes.
Yeah, and you did it remarkably well. And kudos to your daughter, who's got a lovely voice.
Thank you.
There's something to her future, definitely, if she decides to pursue music.
We have an idea for something in the future, maybe next year, the two of us together, now that her piano skills have developed a long way since then as well. So we're working on some stuff together now, which is fun.
Amongst the tunes on the record is Quiet, which I believe is the first song you penned after getting instruction for therapy and for playing your guitar.
Yes.
Talk to me about Quiet, because there is a range of emotion and experience in that song that probably only you could share, because what was going on inside your head. And although you're the only one who can share that, I think a lot of people can feel the anxiety and the angst in that tune. So can you talk a bit about Quiet?
Absolutely. And I will say, and I won't mention any names because I don't have permission to, but there are a number of us in the scene, in the Fish scene particularly, who have, from me posting these things over the last couple of years, have emailed me personally or messaged me saying, thanks for sharing XYZ. And we see each other's posts. And there's like a secret code of people who have dealt with like illness, anxiety, and this kind of stuff. And there's one person in particular I'm thinking of who, she's an incredible human being. And it's kind of fun to watch each other write stuff online. And we kind of like, we'll wink at each other through social media. Like, oh, I see what you're doing. You know, I see what you're working on there. Like, you go, you do it, you know? But so Quiet, yeah, it was the first thing because it was a new experience. You know, when you suffer some kind of mental challenge, it's a very weird sense. For those who know it, they know it. For those who don't, I'll try to express it. But not really having control over the thoughts in your head. Now, I think most of us probably don't have control of our thoughts in our head, but we're not aware of it. When the thoughts are like terrorizing you, you're really aware that you don't have control over it. So the idea of the song really comes from this sense that there's a ton of noise going on in your head. And if you're trying to process all that noise at all the time, it's really overwhelming and can be terrifying. I think most people, the analogy is like passing clouds. You might have a thought like, oh, I wonder if that spider bite could become a staph infection. So most people, maybe the thought comes up and then a millisecond later it's gone and they're back at their work. When you're suffering with this stuff, that thought, can this spider bite become a staph infection, is all you think about for the whole day. And you make 5 different dermatology appointments and you don't trust any of the dermatologists until, you know, one of them tells you you're dying, basically. And that's the only one you'll trust. So this song is about that. It's about that noise in your head. And it was written at a time where I didn't know how to get that noise to quiet down, so to speak. But I had been given this roadmap by my therapist and friend that was, the idea isn't really to make the noise go away, but rather to kind of like just set up like a run-in with the noise. You know, like you want to actually just kind of let it all in and just be like, okay, hey, come on in, hang out, chill for a while. I got stuff to do, but you know, crazy thought that's probably not factual. If you got to hang out for an hour, hang out for an hour, you know? And so that's what the song is about. You know, you long for it to be quiet in your head, but the reality is it never is. And the better approach, or at least the approach that worked for me, I won't say better, I don't know what works for everyone else, but for me was to actually say like, come on noise, bring it on. I'm here. I got stuff to do, but if you want to hang out and have a beer in my brain, go for it. And that's kind of what the song, it traces that sort of recognition and experience about, you know, what people will call in CBT, sticky thoughts that, yes, the more you engage them, the stickier they get.
I Can Ride a Bike is another song on this album. And if I'm not mistaken, you wrote this song on a trip to Baltimore, right at the height.
Yeah.
Was it at the height of?
The height of the pandemic.
The height of the pandemic, but also of your anxiety, right?
Oh, my anxiety. No, you're right. Not during the pandemic. You're 100% right. Yeah.
It was the height of your anxiety.
That's right. Correct. Yeah. It was October. Right. Yep. That's right.
And what's amazing about it is that, it does seem free and easy. And I'm wondering how you get to a place to write these songs when you're having guests drop into your head for a beer. And at the same time, you're cognizant of those friends that are dropping by.
Yeah.
But you're also aware that you need to be in the moments, be on a trip with your family, rent a bike, and go on this on this trip. Like, how did you marry the two to come through it all?
So if you ask my wife how that trip went, that was a very difficult trip. That was one of the worst days mentally I probably ever had in my life on a trip. We went to see my best friend who lives in Baltimore, who was like a real brother, like, you know, as close as another human being could get, and his wife and his young kids. And my wife thought that would be very helpful for me. He's someone that I, you know, we relate on a lot of levels, even though we're very different, and we both love to debate things. You know, we will debate if a black pen is black until the end of time and both be very happy yelling at each other. And she just thought that'd be good for me, which was, you know, great insight on her part. But I had a horrible, it was very difficult for me. And at the end of the trip, my wife and Joshua, they went and they picked up a guitar from one of Joshy's friends or something. And it was just in his house at the end of the trip. This was like the last day we were there. And, you know, I wasn't playing because I was in someone else's house and whatever. I didn't bring a guitar. So I was in a terrible mental state, but Joshie and his wife, Catherine, and my wife were like thick as thieves. So even if we're together, we can all kind of make fun of each other. And I had, when I should have been on that trip, like really responsible watching my kids and like taking part. Joshie lives out in like a forest and he trails that he's built with his own hands and swings that swing across streams. And I should have been engaged with them. And instead I had accepted an invitation to like do some way far out, like, I don't even know what you call it. It's not therapy and it's not, but some woman came to their house and I disappeared for 2 hours in their basement with her trying to like summon the demon, so to speak, because I was just desperate for anything. And we were laughing about how that was not like the right thing to do. And it backfired and they kind of handed me this guitar and they said, just, you know, relax, you know, just enough trying to fix yourself, just freaking relax already. And I started, you know, just playing this F chord with a walking bass line and everyone just kind of started chiming in over that little opening riff with what they like to do. I don't know how it started. Someone said, oh, I like to ride a bike. And someone said, I like to hula hoop and I like to roller skate. We were just being frivolous. And me and my, like, you know, remember the Saturday Night Live skit, Debbie Downer?
Yep.
You know, like, wah, wah. That was like me. So like, you know, Catherine would say, I like to ride a bike. And my wife would say, Michelle would say, you know, I like to roller skate. And I'd be like, I like to not have horrible anxiety feelings anymore, you know?
Sorry, don't mean to laugh, but I get it.
No, I love laughing about it now. So that's what I was doing. But then like, we kept going. We went for 10, 15 minutes, everyone, and it became funny and it lightened me up and it loosened me up. And so at the end, you know, I said, okay, this is my guitar exercise for the day. I've done it. And now I've got these sort of this goofy idea. And then when I went home, when we got back from that trip, I just had the idea of like, well, what if you actually wrote a song about avoidance, which is another area of CBT of therapy, which is, you know, and everyone would say that to you, anyone who's dealt with mental health. And I'm not saying this is wrong. These things are all very helpful. They would say, you know, exercise and go do things you love and play guitar, all wonderful things that are helpful, but they are forms of avoidance. You're trying to distract yourself from whatever feelings you're dealing with. So that became from the germination of the goofing around with my friends trying to light me up. It became this idea for a song of like, I can do all of these things. I can ride a bike. I can hula hoop. I can learn to skydive. But, you know, the refrain is, you know, if you travel too far from your mind, it's never too far behind. Right. So you can do all those things. But if you don't really deal with your mind, you'll be riding your bike for a long time.
Yeah.
Trying to get away from the sticky thoughts. So again, I turned it into the Debbie Downer idea, but the song plays like a children's song. And
I thought of Contact by Phish when I first heard it. It sort of has that it has early Phish feels to it, I think.
Yeah. A couple of people at those matches shows that January after, I mean, that was in October. So that following January before the pandemic, a couple of people came up to me afterwards and said, is that a Trey song? Is that a Phish song?
Yeah.
I said, no, but thanks.
I know that anecdotally, spirituality and religion play a large part in your life. And the song Preacher is interesting because it speaks to some of those themes.
Yeah.
What was the impetus for Preacher? The Preacher. Okay.
So Preacher is really a metaphor, whatever the right grammatical term is. One of the things I did when I just was unhappy with the speed at which I was healing was I did hypnotherapy with a guy who's like a shaman here. I mean, he calls himself, all these people always have great titles for themselves. You know, I maybe it works for some people. I don't know. I'm not going to knock it, but I spent a ton of money on it. And the idea was that he was going to get me into a hypnotic state and he would find the core source of my anxiety from when I was a child. And he would form baby Adam in my mind under hypnosis. And we would, I don't want to belittle it. I'm sure it does work for some people. And I spent a ton of money and tons of weeks doing this. And he was like many guru-ish type people. He was very certain that if I spent the money and I showed up for every session and I allowed myself to go into hypnosis, I would be healed of not only my anxiety, but of every trauma I'd ever experienced in my whole life. But the one thing that he was very helpful for me in recognizing was sort of the blame I was placing on other people for the situation I had been put in. I blame myself a lot for my brother's passing. I thought, well, this is a rehab center that I know, and I know the head psychologist, and I have two friends who are 5 years sober from going to therapy. So if I put my brother-in-law there, he's going to be healed. So I was blaming myself, but I was also blaming lots of other people. And so the impetus for the song was really, this guy in my mind is the preacher. He's the guy telling me, he's the guy in the corner, you know, who's yelling all this stuff at you. And if you're susceptible enough, in my opinion, you'll buy it, you know, like you're standing outside MSG and there's lots of preachers there yelling at you what to believe or you'll burn in hell. And in a sense, this was analogous to that. But what I did get from it was through these hypnosis sessions, is he always wanted me to find conflict that I had with people in my life. So forgive your father for this, forgive your mother for that, forgive your sister. So that's kind of the arc of the lyrics is to recognize that there is you have to be forgiving, not just of yourself, but for other people. And ultimately, like the refrain, you know, comes from Ethics of Our Fathers, Pirkei Avos. And Judaism is a book written of basically every generation for a while. They wrote sort of the leaders of the Jewish communities at the time would write these little sayings that were important for the community to work on. So one of them is make for yourself a teacher and find for yourself a friend, or the reverse. Mm-hmm. I forget. So the refrain is like, that's how the preacher isn't going to help me. You know, the guy yelling at me, do this or you're going to burn in hell, and do this or you're whatever, that's not going to help me. What's going to help me is, you know, having good friends, find a real teacher, you know, find someone who you can really trust. In my case, it was the CBT therapist. And then also be forgiving of all the things that have gotten to the situation. Don't hold all that baggage on when you're trying to heal, because you're just giving yourself extra weight to carry.
It's very profound. Yeah.
The other little thing I'll say about it also personally, and I'm trying to take this on, and I love my parents dearly, and they were a huge help, is that like many Ashkenazi Jews, especially who are products of Holocaust survivors as I am, when this happened to me, my parents showed up and they said, you know, to be there for me and help me and, you know, help with the kids and bad days and where I, you know, didn't want to leave the room and stuff like that. And magically they said, oh, we went through these problems too. You know, dad went through it XYZ ago and you don't remember because we didn't want you to know. And mom went through it after, you know, grandpa died. And I said, well, you know, maybe that would have been useful, you know, information, you know, yeah. Like, you know, but it's, look, I love them. I don't blame them. I get it. You know, you want to protect your kids from being in a bad situation, but you know, then the stuff starts to come out, like, you know, so-and-so is on this medication. So-and-so is doing this. Like, oh, wow. This is like really in our family. Would have been good to know before I lost my mind.
It's an interesting thought because, you know, I do therapy as well. And I've talked about it a few times on the show. And one of the things that I find interesting is that, we are either children or grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. And I still think that the atrocities of that event actually do come down generations. It's something that we're either born with or learned behavior based on,
yep,
survivors' behavior or sons and daughters of survivors. I mean, you know, the anxiety and the tragedy of living through that has been passed down from generation to generation. And I asked my therapist about it and he said, there are studies, you know, so
yeah.
when they say, you know, it was just an event in time and 6 million people unfortunately perished and all of that, it's had a lasting impact on our people, I think, in a very, yeah, profound way that maybe we don't talk about enough and maybe we should.
Yeah.
Let's turn to maybe a more uplifting song. Sure. First of all, I want to compliment your playing throughout. And I know that you're a phenomenal player and people can certainly see that. When you played with Matis Yahu, when you did some of the stuff on your previous records, and even when you were playing just with your daughter and even showing people how to play songs. But yeah. Ways of Man is just stellar. I think your performance is stellar. And either the pedal steel or the slide guitar, which, yeah, is not you, right? It's not.
It's the guy Taylor Burge, who's another player down here. Yeah.
Incredible. Yeah. Talk a bit about, because I think it's this idea that we should give ourselves a little more credit, and we should be very positive about where we are, even when we're dealing with so much in our lives.
Yeah. It was one of the later songs that I wrote. My dad is like, my dad's a very religious person. He became religious later in life when I was towards the end of high school. But the one thing that didn't change about him is his love for Bob Dylan. So, you know, a lot of his life became about practicing Judaism and less about maybe, you know, coaching basketball and things that he had done before he was religious. But the Dylan never changed. So there's a lot of Dylan going on. I go to my parents' house and my dad has a guitar and, you know, let's play Dylan songs, you know? That stuff is like, I don't always play that style, but the nature of like, you know, songs like, you know, Simple Twist of Fate and, you know, just that vibe of those Dylan tunes is like, you know, in my blood, I think at this point. I even remember as like a little kid, it was my dad's birthday. Like, what should I get him? I don't know, get him a Dylan record. You know, I can remember it like, you know, so, you know, that song was my attempt. I think I had like done a cover, not with my daughter. I was just kind of doing it of, I'm blanking on the song. Billy Strings does an amazing version of it. And I was trying to copy his version. I'm blanking
on it. No, Senor. I know I'm trying to remember all the Dylan songs he plays, but it's
yeah,
hard.
But he does this I mean, obviously he's like the master of masters, but he does this incredible, this picking pattern he does for, we'll look it up. But some Dylan tune. And I was doing that. And I said, oh, I had these lyrics for this song already. And I have like five versions of it with the lyrics and none of it felt right. And I was like, oh, maybe this is like the Dylan-esque song, right? Like maybe this is that song. And then I was messing around. And I came up with kind of, you know, a very Dylan-esque type of chord progression.
Yeah.
But lyrically, it's kind of just like, I think it's a little self-explanatory, but the idea is, you know, I'll take another concept from like spiritual Judaism, which is like, have you ever heard the story where I forget who says it, some, you know, great rabbi from 2000 years ago, he would hold two pieces of paper in his pocket, right? One piece of paper said the whole world was made just for me. And the other piece of paper would say, I'm nothing but, you know, dust and ashes. And the idea was like, you know, to recognize, to give yourself credit, if I exist, you know, there must be a reason for me to exist. So the world is here in essence for me to elevate it, to be part of it, to be kind to it, to make it better. But at the same time, you know, we're billions of years in and, you know, in the grand scheme of things, what are we, you know, really in the grand scheme of the universe, you know, but nothing. So there's that humility, but there also has to be that confidence in your life. So the story of that song is sort of balancing those two things where give yourself credit, but recognize the credit you give yourself for being who you are should also be applied to other people, right? The easiest analogy given for that I like is, and we all experience it if we've ever been in a traffic, you know, is like when you're rushing to get somewhere, you have a reason that you cut that guy off, right? Your wife's giving birth in the back seat, you're late to pick up your kids at school, you're whatever the reason. There's a reason, and the guy honking at you for coming off, he just doesn't understand your reason. If he did, he wouldn't be so mad at you. But when someone cuts you off in traffic, oh man, they're an a-hole.
Right.
What a jerk. You know, he's trying to get you. He's trying to kill you. He's trying to, you know, have an accident. He's on his phone, whatever the reasons are. So the idea of that song is you don't know what's coming. You don't know if today's going to feel like a day like the whole world is for you, or if it's a day that's going to feel like you're nothing but dust and ashes.
Right.
So balance them out. Be aware of it. Be kind. You know, sometimes I listen to the lyrics when I listen to it back and yeah, it's a little cheesy, you know, but I like it.
Open Sea, if I'm correct, is the last song that you wrote for the album.
Yeah.
And originally you had worked up some lyrics for it and you had, were really psyched about it. And then you took it to Arturo and said, maybe this needs some strings. Maybe this isn't the song yet, or maybe we've done too much here. How do you know when it's too much? How do you know when it should be an instrumental song, like the way the record opens, or which is the Open Sea, I believe. How do you know when it should be an instrumental and when it should be something with lyrics?
So, I mean, again, everything, if you look at the other two records that I put out and the records I've played on with bands that are on Spotify or wherever as well, they're all instrumental. There's not one lyric on any of those records. And like the main solo record I did is all fingerstyle guitar work. So lyric writing was relatively new for me, at least taking it seriously. So my first sense was I had all these lyrics I had been writing, and I had this whole concept of the sea as an analogy and the horizon. And I had a few moments and like, really, I'm very fortunate to work right across the street from the beach here in Miami Beach, where our office is. So there were days where I would just leave work and go swim in the ocean because it just felt wonderful. But there were also days where I'd be in the ocean and be like, maybe I should just swim out to the horizon and see what the hell happens to me. Right. Like when you're depressed or like you have crazy thoughts.
Yeah.
And as my therapist said, the difference between someone who's crazy and not crazy is the not crazy person actually doesn't swim out to the horizon line and find out what happens. So, so I had these ideas for a song and it wasn't coming together lyrically. Right. And I thought, you know, I remember reading years ago, an interview with probably Trey when they wrote Time Turns Elastic, and we don't have to comment on the song one or the other, but it's on a record, obviously, where that's the big, you know, compositional piece on that record. And it's the only one. And I was kind of thinking like, nobody really knows who I am so much, but I know myself as someone who can play this finger style guitar music. And there isn't any of that on the record. So do I have to have my one, right? It was more conceptual. Like, do I have to have my one finger style song, you know, because that's how I think of myself.
Right.
So on this record of somewhat simple folk rock reggae-ish tunes, do I need the one like flashy piece where I'm playing a lot of notes in my right hand and it's in an alternate tuning and there's a weird time signature thing that happens in between the sections? Do I need that to kind of show people what I think of myself as doing? And I thought, yes, I do need that. Mm-hmm. So I scrapped the lyrics and I said, this is just going to be, I'm going to write another section to the instrumental and I'll make it even a little fancier. And then, you know, at the time, honestly, one of the big things I did, I mean, I've been, you know, I'm unabashedly a Phish fan. I don't care what anyone says. They're the greatest live band to ever exist. And I will fight you to the death over that statement. That's my opinion and I'm sticking to it.
second best maybe, but okay.
I mean, I never got to see the Dead. So
okay. That's fair. Yes.
I was in offered your to see them
in yeah, your lifetime.
I was offered to exactly. In my lifetime, I was offered to see the Dead in 95. I passed, I was like 14 years old or something. And then Jerry died that summer. Anyways. So, you know, I really spent a lot of time during the pandemic, not only learning these Phish and Dead and Vampire Weekend and whatever covers with my daughter, but I learned every single fingerstyle Trey song, every one. I learned every single one. If Again from Ghosts of the Forest, you know, Discern, the ones people forget about, Discern, Sparks. What's the other one? It's called Radon Balloon from Oysterhead. I learned every single one, and they're in they're in different tunings, open D, open C, you know, and I learned them all. So I wrote this song kind of while doing that, and then I was listening, you know, I would go on YouTube and put on, let's say, you know, the In-Law Josie Wales or whatever, and I would slow it down to half speed or three, just to, you know, make sure I got the right voicings and I'm playing it exactly the way I think Trey is playing it. And a lot of those arrangements, Radon Balloon from his solo record and Discern, the intro section, they have strings. So then I said, oh, you know, this is kind of in that style, though it's my finger style patterns. And strings are a beautiful accompaniment and Arturo can write for strings. He can write for anything. So I went to him and I said, okay, there's no more lyrics to this song. You know, find me two violinists and a cellist and let's work on an arrangement for this, really in that style. I mean, really in the style, the fact that I was learning that stuff. Now, in terms of if it's too much or not too much, I am not a great arranger of strings or horns, so I relied very much on Arturo. And I'm being honest here, I wanted a little bit of ego to come through where, hey, listen what he actually can do on guitar. It's just, in some ways, this is my first time having a record label. This is my first time doing a lot of this stuff since college in 20 years. So maybe it's the first time people are going to really hear me. I want them to know I can also really play.
Right.
So I didn't want the strings to overdo it. I wanted them to hear that my right hand is doing what it's doing in my left hand. Yeah. So there's a little bit of ego in it for sure. Pride. But that was the way I thought through that song.
So you have all these songs, and Arturo's obviously been a big help putting these songs together. And you knew that you wanted to have him, obviously, when you produced the record. But you also called on one of your boyhood heroes, who I think many of us in the scene appreciate. And that's Mark Friedman, who plays a whole bunch of instruments on this record, but is best known for being the bass player in The Slip. How did you reach out to Mark and get him involved in the project?
I mean, I just honestly just asked him. I love Mark. Like, he's the greatest. I mean, I was obsessed with The Slip in college. I mean, I wish they kept playing. I flew up to Philly to see one of the reunion shows. You know, they're the greatest. They really just are. But in college, the band I was in college, we used to, not only did I like run around chasing The Slip around the Midwest, I went to school in St. Louis, but our band opened up for them, and those guys would crash at our house when they were in St. Louis. And so, you know, we had a distant friendship, I would say closest with Mark than anyone else. But I sort of rekindled that friendship maybe 4 years ago or so, when in my world, when podcasts were really taking, you know, off, and I started spending all this time listening to, you know, you and, you know, all kinds of other stuff, you know, everything. Yeah. I was like, oh, I should have a podcast too. Why not? You know, so I made this ridiculous podcast where I just interviewed my friends from college that I didn't know what they were doing. And it was like a way for everyone else of our crew from college to know what other people were doing without having to actually call each individual person. So we had this like 40 person list where I try to interview everyone. And we made fake commercials. So like that would like poke fun at like inside jokes about that person. You know, like we have one friend who's South African, but he turns out the accent's put on, like he doesn't really need the accent. And we found that out from his older sister, like after college. So like the fake commercial on the podcast was about learning how to put on fake accents. And we actually hired like a guy who does real voiceover work for like real advertisement agencies to do the ad. Like we went all out on like goofing on our friends. So at one point I thought, well, wouldn't it be cool to like interview other people who are like involved in our core group of friends? So Mark was one of those people. Our band lived down in Boulder for a while and we played shows with The Slip then. And anyway, so I called Mark. I was like, will you be on this ridiculous podcast and I'll push it out? And he was like, sure. So that was like kind of how we rekindled our friendship many years later. And he did that, which it's that episode's out there somewhere. I do not do that podcast anymore. It's very short lived. But that was awesome that he did it. So, you know, we had been in contact because of that. And we talked about, you know, The Slip reuniting, we were in touch. So when the pandemic came, I needed a mixing engineer. I think I was talking to Mark actually about the teaching platform. I was another thing I was using my time to do. I tried my hand at building an online teaching platform during the pandemic also. And I wanted Mark to teach on there. And I think in just one conversation, he's just like, yeah, I'm mixing a lot of records now. You know, that's what I'm doing during the pandemic. You know, a lot of people coming from mixing. I was like, I have a record. You want to mix it? And he was like, sure, let me hear it. And if I dig it, I'll mix it. So I sent him like a lot of the stems. And in like one of the greatest emotional like moments in my adult life, he not only liked it, but he was like, he's like, I have some ideas here. Do you mind if I add a bass part here? Do you mind if I add percussion? He's like, I think in, you know, Preacher, there's this reggae break, you know, what if I added like clavinet or moog or something and like fill out the break? And I was like, dude, if Mark Friedman wants to add to my record, like carte blanche, man, like have at it. And it was like the coolest thing. It was really meaningful to me. And he did an amazing job, not just adding his creativity into it, but just the mix, just he brought so much out of it. Especially with the vocal stuff, which was new to me, you know, writing vocal harmonies and all that kind of stuff. So he was super helpful. And yeah, we're in touch with it now. He just actually helped me with making some instrumental stems for some other stuff I need the music for. So that was just a thrill. And I love Mark.
The other unique thing about this project, and I have to tell you, it is amazing, is this 32-page book. And what's amazing about it, aside from the fact that you are giving your audience lyrics, which, you know, if you are just listening to these things on Spotify now or on Nugs or whatever, you don't necessarily have lyrics, but now you have the lyrics in this beautiful book. But what really makes this book Beautiful is the work of Mel Marcello, who unfortunately passed away.
Yes.
How did you hook up with this legendary San Diego designer who whose work is, I mean, unparalleled and absolutely gorgeous? How did you hook up with him and talk a bit about the relationship?
Sure. So first of all, a lot of love to Mel's sister and his parents and everything. You know, Mel passed away the first weekend in March of a heart attack in his sleep. He's 51 years old, marathon runner, great shape, incredible human being. So really, really sad. But Mel, so for my main, you know, the production work I do, I mainly do a lot of work for the singer Andrea Bocelli. So like 6 or 7 years ago, we played San Diego, and Mel, even to the day he died, I think Bad Bunny was the last artist he was working on for the Pechanga Arena, the old sports arena in San Diego. He was like their in-house poster artist. So he would make these incredible posters for artists as gifts. They weren't to be sold. There were these one of a kind things that Mel would make for every show. And you can, his Instagram page is still live and you can see his sketches and some of the work. If you go to Mel Marcello stuff, his Instagram handle's Mel Tendo, like Nintendo, but Mel Tendo. Just incredible work. So we became fast friends because he was, you know, he was a kindred spirit in a sense of he just did art whenever he could. Didn't matter if it was paying his bills or not. He just was going to do art. And we hit it off. And then I hired him to do like unique poster work for Bocelli, for Andrea Bocelli, like touring stuff. I hired him. And then anytime we came back to San Diego, he did the posters. And then Matt Disyahu on one run saw his work. I think in my office, he was down here. We have beautiful poster he did in Braille because Bocelli's blind. So he made these posters with actual Braille that Bocelli could read. And I think Matt just saw it and was like, you know, what's that? And I told him about Mel. I was like, oh, I need Mel. You know, I need a Mel. So we did a run, which was a funny idea I had for Matt just years ago, because I would book these runs for him that I would play in the band and book the shows and wear every hat that was in it, book it, I'd promote it, I'd play the gig, I'd open the gig. That was the relationship we had. And I always had this funny idea, I thought, because, you know, when he would come to South Florida where I live, we'd book like 5 or 6 shows and all up and down. And I always thought it'd be funny to do a photo shoot with Matt just playing shuffleboard, because he would always come during the winter, you know, and it'd be like your grandfather's winter vacation, but you're going to see Matt Disyahu instead. So we never did a photo shoot of that. But instead I said, I have an idea. Let's hire Mel and we'll do this like graphic image of you playing shuffleboard, like at the, you know, the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami where all the, you know, old Jews come to stay. And we'll make it like a winter tour poster. And he loved the idea. And Mel like knocked it out of the park. And then, you know, Mattis, I know, was again, sadly working with Mel on some other stuff when he passed away. So I just tried to get Mel involved in stuff. I loved him so much. He completely undervalued his talent, in my opinion. I always told him, you know, charge more, you know, charge me more, you know, like you deserve it. He didn't care. He just wanted to do art and live his life. There were some really beautiful memorials to him in San Diego after he passed away with some of his artwork. And yeah, we just were always in touch. I mean, about stuff. Anytime I had any art idea, I would call Mel. And if he couldn't do it, he didn't do it. But he was my first call for anything, you know, art related. And, you know, I thought, listen, this is my chance. Like, I'm really proud of this music. I want fans to connect to it. You know, when I would do these recordings, by the way, at night when I was in therapy, and I don't want people who are listening who haven't heard my music, I'm speaking like as if this is like really depressing stuff.
It's actually very great.
The music's not. The music's not. Yeah, the music's not. So give it a chance. The music's very uplifting. It's like Sting once said about the Police. You know, he wrote the saddest lyrics with the most upbeat music, something like that. So similar in that vein. But it's hopeful, hopeful. The lyrics are all very hopeful, hence the title. But anyways, so, you know, when Mel and I were talking about this stuff, I said, okay, let's do the album cover. And then I said, but I want this to speak for itself more than just the music. There's something else here. And we threw around ideas like we'll make a poster for every song. And we'll, you know, Mel apparently had told me that like jewel cases, like tape cases, you know, like our old tape cases were coming back. And he showed me he was creating stuff for some bands where people made collectible like cassette tape cases. I was like, I don't believe you that cassette tapes are coming back, Mel. I think your information's off or something. So then we set out to do it for a book, you know? So I was like, let's make a book, and we'll take this idea of making a unique piece of art for every image, for every song. And so that's what we did. And I mean, you know, he crushed it. I mean, the most common statement I get from people who have seen me promoting the book but haven't heard of the record, oh, I hope the music's as good as the art.
I can say emphatically it is. The other thing too is that the videos that have gone along with this, Quiet is out already, but it also, you use the artwork obviously in those as well, right?
Yeah, we hired a good animator, Regime Music Group, who's putting the record out, who've been incredibly kind and amazing to me. They found a great animator who would just honor Mel's art without screwing with it too much, but like find really cool ways to animate it, which to me is just like, you know, more life for Mel kind of thing.
Now, assuming your day job is back on and you are going to be probably doing a world tour with Andrea, I would assume soon enough, I'm sure he's aching to get out there. What's next for you in terms of playing the music on this record and getting people out to see you play these great songs?
Yeah. So thank you. So yeah, my goal is to play out and a lot. I mean, we handle Bocelli and some other artists just in North America, which I mean, we did since October of 21, we've already done about 28 Bocelli shows, and we've got another 20 something that we'll be doing. But Andrea's touring schedule does allow for a really good work-life balance. He is a family man and he wants to be home, and he does not go out on the road for 4 or 5 months at a time. It's 3 weeks here, four weeks there, and plenty of time in between. So yeah, I'm working with a friend of mine who's an agent, and the Regime Music Group people, and they're helping me out, and I'm looking to do shows. Hopefully we'll get them announced, you know, record comes out May 13th. So we'll hopefully get a lot of them confirmed, you know, by the end of May, to do stuff at end of July and then do it again in October. So do a couple short runs, 2 to 3 weeks each time. But my goal is to play out as much as I can.
Before I let you go, we chatted briefly, and you've already mentioned that they're the best band of all time. So let's talk about New Year's in April while I have you.
Okay. Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
What? I think it's, I'm speechless. Like, I don't even know where to begin. You know, Trey played a few shows, obviously those solo shows. But for the most part, with only a handful of shows from that time you saw them in Mexico till the last run, they've only played a handful of shows, and then they show up at MSG and they just kick ass.
And they annihilate. Yes.
First of all, what was your favorite show of the four show run?
So I've been trying to take long runs and listen to them because I didn't get to make any of the shows. I did have tickets to the original run. Thanks a lot, Omicron. It was funny. We were with Bocelli at MSG the week before we had shows there, I think 15 and 16 of December. Yeah. So 10 days before, whatever it was. And I was sitting in the box office with my friends who I've been working with there for 15 years. And I said, thanks for letting me buy these tickets to Fish. I'm going to buy flights for my wife and I. They're not canceling, right? And they said, there is no way Fish is canceling. Not a chance. So anyways, thanks American Airlines for refunding my plane tickets. But anyways, I mean, for me, you know, I'm one of those people at this point where I don't care what songs they play anymore. I really don't. Like, you know, I feel very lucky that since I was 15, 16 years old, I've been getting to see them. I've seen every song. I'm not chasing any songs in that regard. I don't have that mentality. They could get on stage and improvise for 3 hours for all I care. I'd be a very happy boy. So for me, like I listened the other day, I listened to the simple, I forget what night it was from, but the simple Into Egg in a Hole. And I thought, you know, just the playing was great. And the No Man's was really great. Obviously I've watched the set from the fake New Year's Eve, like 8 times. And it's
the
just
stunt, the waves and sand.
The stunt is just amazing. And I love Waves. That's just one of my favorite tunes. I just absolutely love the vibe, the feel, the groove of that song. I don't know. They're incredible. We got to go to Mexico. My wife and I got to go to Mexico just now, you know, whenever that was, a few months ago, which was amazing. But I personally had, you know, the time of my life I got to the Bocelli tour that we did between October and February. I got very lucky in that we were kind of just right behind Fish in the sense that we actually played the Hollywood Bowl the same day Fish played the Forum. So we were like really following them. Like we were on the same routing. So anytime I had a day off and Fish was playing, I went. So it was Vegas and Santa Barbara and I don't know, Phoenix, other ones. And I was just having the time of my life. I was just running and working my shows and then going to, and I was just, you know, I was just in heaven at all of it. To be honest, I just think for me, I have a very close friend down here in Miami, who, you know, we've been to a ton of shows together and, you know, we'll talk opinions on how they're playing or whatever, but you know, he made a comment to me the other day that he was listening to Sirius and he said, oh, they were playing, you know, Fluffhead from 95 at the show I was at. And so I listened to the Fluffhead opener from, you know, the last night of just now in April. And, you know, they're really not the same band anymore. And I wrote back, I said, okay, you know, I'm not going to argue that they're not maybe as tight or whatever when they play the long comps. I just said, but for 42 year old guy like me, I'll take the way they improvise now over any other era. And maybe, you know, maybe people tell me I forgetting is a good thing. You forgot what they sounded like when you were there in 96, but right. I don't think so. I think the communication that those four guys have on stage now is unparalleled. And for someone who's a bit of a music nerd like myself, and I, if you watch the little videos I post, the little lessons and stuff like that, like, I get a big high from understanding the theory behind this stuff and what it can teach me about playing and songwriting. And if you really pay attention, there's guys out there who do this much better than I do. There's that guy who like maps the Fish jams, you know? But the ease with which they modulate keys and change rhythms and reharmonize what's going on and try things like, maybe there's not a million notes a second. Okay, fine. I don't really care anymore. Like, honestly, my brain, I don't think I take it anymore anyways. But just the narrative arc that they create harmonically, melodically, it's just, I don't know. For me, it's the biggest gift in the world. And one day it won't be here. And so, you know, I'm happy to complain. People can call me out and go online and watch the reviews that every now and then I write about stuff that I don't like. But that's because you love something, you know, when you love something, you want it, you're open to being honest about the things you like or don't like about it. And, you know, I love them.
You know, for me, it's like, and I see them, unfortunately, you know, they only come up to Toronto every three years or so.
Got to get you out of there.
Well, I'd like to see more, but you know, there's other concessions and other things going on too. But I saw them at Fenway a couple years ago, two nights, and I thought they were amazing. And that was after seeing a Toronto show that many Torontonians thought was lackluster. And that's because he played a lot of Story of the Ghost stuff, which not Story of the Ghost. Uh-huh.
Joy or
no, Big the or solo record.
One of the ones.
The solo, his, Ghost of the Forest. Right. So he played a lot of that, but I love that. Like, I love all of those jams and stuff. So for me, it's like every time I see them, there's something new and something enjoyable. And I for my money, I think they're playing as well now as they did, you know, in 90, when I first started seeing them in 95, 94, like those were fresh and exciting, but this is like, these guys have honed their skills and each one of them is probably amongst the top players at their position. Like, it's like watching an all-star game.
Yeah, nobody does.
It's like watching an all-star game every night out.
I'll tell you one last, I agree with you 100%. I'll tell you one last funny story about Ghost of the Forest, because that record, it was a very meaningful record. You know, Trey wrote it, obviously, by his friend who passed away. And so it was a good record to listen to when you're dealing with someone who passed away and you're seeing how someone writes. But I've had general anesthesia three times in my adult life. Two are for normal things that adults need to have. And every time I come out of that propofol, that medication they give you for it, singing, not at will, I'm just singing when I wake up. So my wife has been there all three times, obviously, you know, someone needs to drive you home. So the first time, which was years ago, you know, like all good Ashkenazi Jews, again, we have colon issues in our family. So, you know, my grandmother had colon cancer. My mom had all these issues. Obviously, I had to have a colonoscopy a bit earlier than I would have liked, you know, just based on genetics. And I woke up singing, I don't even know what it's called, but it's that. And so my wife said, was that playing in the operator, you know, in the room? I said, no. Okay. Second time I had it, I woke up singing Heathen by Bob Marley. So I don't know what was going on there. And the third time I woke up singing Drift While You're Sleeping. And it was while I was making this record. I was, you know, I had gone while I was losing, you know, losing my mind's a bad phrase, but not mentally very strong. And I had convinced myself that I needed a full like body scan of what was going on because I was clearly a mess. And I convinced them to do this whole thing to me. And everyone just let me do it because they didn't want to deal with me anymore at the time. And I woke up, like, my wife says, like, in tears singing Drift While You're Sleeping while I was writing this record. And I went home and I learned that song note for note, I think, like, that night. And the next night I made a lesson on YouTube about how to play that song. I became obsessed with that song. Not that I have any idea of why I was singing it. I don't think I was particularly listening to it at the time, but anyways, that's my.
Well, I'll let you know. I'm going Monday for a similar thing. And I'm excited for my propofol. Best sleep ever.
I think feel great when you wake up.
The only thing Michael Jackson had going on was his love of propofol. Anyway, thanks so much. I know that note. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for taking the time, man. Really appreciate the music, the record.
Thank you so much.
And can't wait to hook up with you at a show or even see you live.
Absolutely.
So
I'll try to make it to
Toronto. Seen fans want you to come here, so hopefully you'll make it up here. Be well, and then we'll see you real soon, all right?
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Aside from being super talented and in tune with his music, Adam Weinberg represents a great inspiration for people coping with mental illness and death. The album, Laugh, Cry, Grief, Hope, is a wonderful mix of thoughtful acoustic goodness combined with very strong songwriting. You should follow Adam on Facebook and other platforms at Adam Weinberg Music for record release details and much more. Before we leave you, let's listen to another track off of Laugh, Cry, Grief, Hope, due out May 13th, wherever you get music. Here is Your Time.
Gonna tell me that I did something wrong. And ain't nothing gonna bring you back round. And your time was on your side. At least you said it was. But you ain't coming home.
just really go
home. You've been listening to the Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. For more, visit thesoundpodcast.com.